And the news was read by Tom Saunders. This is BBC Radio 4. In a moment, a taxidermist, cartoonist and an impressionist meet. No, it's not my dream dinner party, but they are plotting how to blow up the galaxy. That's next.
Music education in the UK has been in decline for years.
We've actually seen an overall decrease in the number of schools that are offering those qualifications. It's decreased by about 35% over the last 10 years.
But music plays an important part in our lives, from the classroom...
It's very good for the emotional well-being of children.
...to the economy.
We want to be doing as well as we possibly can do, because this island exports so much music across the whole of the world.
I'm Soweto Kinch, a musician. And I'm finding out what needs to be done to keep UK music alive. Rethinking Music on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds starts tomorrow morning at 11:30.
The Museum of Curiosity now on Radio 4, where we are asking the question, how much soup would it take to destroy the galaxy?
Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Solent University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, a vast and imposing edifice expanding faster than the visible universe, but with a snug and woolly vibe, cosier than the cosiest tea cosy. And here's the bobble on our hat, the museum's curator, Anna Tuschinski.
Hello, John.
Hello, Anna. And how's your green policy for the museum going?
Ah, well, so glad you have asked. You know that revolving display of pork pies in the cafe?
Now, let me guess. Is it now powered by a donkey on a treadmill?
No, because that's obviously ridiculous. It's been replaced by a herd of wild boar and a rack of spears. I'm afraid if you want meat from now on, you're going to have to earn it.
Right. Well, on that note, let's meet this week's steering committee. Fresh from the pub and all completely ist, dramatist and impressionist Steve Nallen, artist and taxidermist Polly Morgan, and roboticist turned cartoonist Randall Munro. Hello.
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 So, Steve, first of all, you've done a lot of celebrities in your time. Can you remember who was the first celebrity you impersonated?
I was about 6 years old and I listened to Dame Edith Evans reading children's stories, and she had a weird voice and I loved it. And I'll give you a burst. To be born, or at any rate to bred, in a handbag seems to me to display contempt for the decencies of family life. I'm six. Imagine that coming out of you when you're six. There we are.
Polly, what was the first animal you taxidermised, if that's the verb?
It was a pigeon. A humble pigeon.
Gosh.
A street pigeon.
Did you just found it? Or
no, I specifically wanted a pigeon. And I think it was found for me by George, the teacher that I found up in Edinburgh.
Randall, you write comics for a living, but you started out building robots for NASA. So will a robot ever be able to do your current job?
I don't know. I sort of hope so.
You just want the time off.
I like reading jokes. And if I could get a computer to generate jokes, then I could just read those. It would be great.
Well, now, Steve, you're an actor, writer, drama teacher, and a man of many voices. You began your career in the 1970s on the Northern Working Men's Club circuit before sweeping to invisible national fame as one of the key impressionists on Spitting Image, where you brought to life a multitude of characters, including Margaret Thatcher, Andrew Lloyd Webber, and the Queen Mum. Your work ranges from stage and screen to video games and puppetry, and you've recently published your first novel for young adults, The Time That Never Was, based on your extraordinary childhood. You've done so many things. Tell me about your whole life, from your earliest memories till we met at Spitting Image in 1983. Briefly.
Well, it was Hitchcock who said that drama is life with the boring bits cut out. So let me just, the first thing I remember actually was being in hospital because I had consumption when I was three.
Crikey.
And I was sent away and, in isolation. And then the next thing that had a big impact on my life was my mother came home. I was about 9 years old, and she came home and she just sat on a couch and died. My father was schizophrenic, so my sister and I had five difficult years with him. And then we ran away and lived in my grandmother's attic. But the odd thing about all this is that it sounds like the Yorkshireman sketch from Monty Python, but actually it was the best possible childhood for somebody who wants to be a writer or a performer. We all have survival mechanisms. And my weird survival mechanism was to talk to myself in the future. I was always interested in the idea of time travel. And the future me said, look, don't worry about all this. It'll turn out okay in the end.
So I was producing this would-be puppet show, which we hadn't started, and we couldn't find a really good Margaret Thatcher. And you wrote to me saying, I can do Margaret Thatcher. And I thought, oh, okay, I'm a BBC trained guy. I got to see everybody. So this guy turns up. I think you were wearing a boiler suit, Steve.
Something like that, yes.
You were very young. And I said, okay, fine, do your Thatcher impression then, please. And you said, well, I'd rather you ask me a question as if I was the Prime Minister. And I said, oh, I really must get on. Okay, Prime Minister, can you tell us about the current state of the British economy?
Oh, goodness me, you know, we're not in a very good state at all. It's very, very sad. You know, I spent 11 and a half years getting Britain back to where it should be, Great Britain. And look what has happened since. I don't know why you're laughing. It isn't funny.
Polly, so I don't know why, because we're talking about puppets and things. Mm. If somebody commissioned you, would you agree to stuff a human being?
No. I have been asked.
Have you?
I have. Well, I believe it was a genuine request. They put so much care and attention into the email and the backstory that I felt like it must be genuine. He straight away just launched off into this story about his grandmother and what a treasured member of the family she was. I was sort of reading it with this growing sense of doom, thinking, why is he telling me about his grandmother? He said she sits in front of the TV all day in the same armchair. And she's a big fan of taxidermy. And she said to us recently, I thought, it's coming. How about getting me stuffed when I die? So we did have a discussion as a family. And they decided they'd like to have her sitting in the same armchair with them in perpetuity. And would I be able to facilitate this? And I'm ashamed to say, I don't think I even replied to the email. I was a bit shocked.
Steve, what do you make of that?
I was thinking, why is it that I'm good at doing indomitable women, be like Beryl Reid or Margaret Thatcher? And I think it was my grandmother. You know, I lived with this wonderful woman, and she was exactly like those people. She didn't speak like them and she didn't have their jobs, but I was sort of attracted to, and I think that's the psychology coming through of why I'm connected to these alpha women.
Thank you so much, Steve. Maybe afterwards you can teach Anna how to do an impression of me, and then I can take the rest of the series off. Coming to you now, Polly, you're a British artist living and working in London. You have no formal art education, but you're self-taught and make use of unusual materials like concrete, polyurethane, and of course, dead animals. You've worked with Banksy at exhibitions all over the world, and you've recently opened a new taxidermy exhibition called False Flags. Tell me, what's that all about?
Well, the title I've taken, as it's a practice in naval warfare of raising a neutral or enemy flag to misrepresent your identity. And I'm kind of using that as an example of the power play between predator and prey, where camouflage and mimicry and subterfuge are used to communicate deceptive messages.
You're not sort of setting up prey and predator in a sort of tableau.
No, it's not quite as literal as that. No, I'm being a little bit kind of looser.
It is art, isn't it? You're using taxidermy as an art form, like a rat curled up in a champagne glass or something like that. It's not just stuffing them.
I've never been a very traditional taxidermist. Well, I never have been a traditional taxidermist. I learned the craft from traditional taxidermists in order to then kind of subvert it a bit, I guess.
Your work is incredibly visceral, Polly, when you first see it. I mean, do people react sort of violently? Do you get hate mail or anything like that?
I've had a little bit of hate mail over the years, but nothing that I can't really handle.
Problem is, if you were to send you a dead thing in the post, that's doing you a favour, really.
Oh, well, exactly. A horse head on the bed would be quite useful. I'd just skin it and mount it.
Thanks, Polly. Maybe it's time we opened a taxidermy wing in the museum. We could absolutely stuff it with stuffed... Well, look, I'll get my coat. So, over to you, Randall. You left your job building robots at NASA to draw cartoons full-time in 2006. Your amazing XKCD is described as a webcomic of romance, sarcasm, maths, and language, and is archived by the USA's Library of Congress. As its creator, you have won a Hugo Award at the World Science Fiction Convention. That is honestly my ambition in life. And have had an asteroid named after you. As well as your collected comic strips, you've written four books. Your most recent, What If 2, provides serious scientific answers to absurd hypothetical questions. So what's the most absurd question you have ever asked somebody else?
Well, I was really excited to sort of learn over the course of doing my comics that, you know, people who do real serious scientific research will sometimes read them. And I have found if I reach out to them, they're often happy to answer questions that I would assume they would find too ridiculous to answer. So I always have a lot of fun talking to experts in things, scientists. And one of my favorites was I talked to Chris Hadfield, former commander of the International Space Station and test pilot. And I first talked to him for my previous book, How To, about how to land a plane, where my plan was I was going to come up with scenarios. Suppose you closed your sleeve in the cockpit door and you couldn't reach the controls, but you could throw dinner rolls from the in-flight meal at the controls. And I was expecting that I would ask him more and more ridiculous questions and he would just hang up on me eventually. But I got through my entire list of questions and he just gave answers for all of them. It turns out test pilots are very hard to fluster by throwing strange situations at them.
I was just looking at XKCD today and God, that's a rabbit hole. You just can't get off it.
I know, it is dangerously addictive, XKCD. And you must have lots of people doing it.
Oh, it's all me.
It's all you, really. You must get nothing else done.
You know, I post a comic 3 times a week. The people who did all the newspaper comics I read growing up, though, like, you know, Calvin and Hobbes and The Far Side, they do 7 times a week.
Wow.
So really, I'm a slacker.
And the other thing I wanted to know is, because you've written a book called Thing Explainer, Complicated Stuff in Simple Words. So obviously, you know, the part of what you do is always making things as simple as possible. Was the simplicity of your stick figures a conscious choice based on that, or are you terrible at drawing?
I mean, there's synergy there. It's a little bit of both. The thing with stick figures is that it's all about simplifying to remove the parts of an image that aren't as important, because then that sort of highlights what you include. And sometimes a really simple drawing can be easier to project yourself onto. Like when there's an emergency exit sign and there's a little figure running over the door, it's not carrying a handbag. It doesn't have, you know, a hairstyle. You don't put clothes on it. Because if you did, you'd be like, oh, who is that person? You know, why do they have that bag?
Yeah.
Where did they get that jacket? You know, you're like, what story am I being told here? But when it's just the figure, just enough to show that the person is running, you can see yourself in it. You think, oh, that's a sign telling me about running and something I should do.
That's great.
Thank you, Randall. I've never written a comic book, so I don't know if it's rocket science exactly, but then I don't know anything about rocket science either. And that's just two of the many things that qualify me to be the world's only, well, as far as I know, professor of ignorance. Okay, Anna, let's open up the vault, please.
Security check.
What is it this time?
Okay, I'm going really old school. We're going back to ancient Egypt.
Are you going to ask me the riddle of the Sphinx? Because I already know the answer.
No, I'm not going to ask you that anymore. I declare the museum open for donations. Steve, what would you like to donate to the museum?
A tiny little thing really in our body, terribly underrated. So I think the human larynx, and more specifically, my little larynx, once I've finished with it.
That's very self-sacrificing of you. And why?
Well, no, I mean, I'm going to keep it till the very end. And then you can have it. And Polly can stuff it.
I don't stuff throats. It's not part of my job. You stuff the whole thing.
No, I really don't. No, I skin the body and I bin it all. I'm sorry.
All right, we'll call off the dissectors for now. But why is it that you would like us to have your larynx?
Impressionists, we micromanage our larynx. But sometimes if you practice a voice for too long, you can actually cause yourself damage. And I did a voice from Family Guy. It was a very strangulated voice, and it caused me a problem. So I had to go and they wanted to see if I was all right. And so they put a camera down my throat. And they said, while you're here, can we record you? And we'd like to use it in teaching. And they said it was the second most interesting larynx they'd ever seen. And I said, well, who's the first? And I don't mind coming second to a ventriloquist.
Randall, what would you think is the most extraordinary body part?
I don't know. I think maybe the strangest part of the body might be the bone marrow, you know, the sites where the immune system does a lot of its development. Man, the more I've learned about how the immune system works, the more I think, wow, that's just the coolest thing in the world. Mm. You have these cells that they'll like find a piece of a virus or a particle that it doesn't like, and then they parade it past a gauntlet of immune cells and like activate them. And then those immune cells are sent past different tissues in the body to make sure it doesn't activate and lock onto any of those. And if it makes it through both those processes, it's sent out into the body to protect you. And so it's like you have this whole factory in you that's developing new antibodies and new T cells and things to protect you. I feel like it's completely outside my control. It's just like I have this swarm of autonomous robots patrolling my body that I don't know anything about or how they work. And I think that's just fascinating.
Bone marrow is a very good way to commit the perfect crime, I've always thought, because if you do receive bone marrow from a donor, which, by the way, everyone should be bone marrow donors because very important and needed. If you receive it, then your DNA becomes the DNA of the donor, I believe. So then you can do whatever you like and they'll get the blame.
Yeah, I know a guy whose blood type changed after he got a bone marrow donation.
No.
So he had to like update all his forms.
Wow.
No, that's amazing.
Yeah, extraordinary.
But bone marrow, is it in all the bones or how does that work?
Well, I'm not a biologist by any means. I don't know. Polly, maybe you know more about bone marrow.
No, I'm feeling guilty here. I chuck it all away.
Yeah, no,
all
I
of
think,
this good
I think...
stuff you're describing. I'm so superficial. I just keep the skin. Sorry, your larynx would go straight in the bin, Steve.
So, Steve, you're donating your larynx once you're done with it. How would you like us to display it?
Would it, for example, would it sit on the plinth, Steve, and still work so that you could forever be doing impersonations of people? Perhaps you... it could be Roy Hattersley announcing, you know, closing and opening times at the museum.
Well, of course I could, and the opens whenever you want it to, and it closes when we decide it closes, and it will not close before we decide it will close, and that's the policy of the Labour Party.
The thing about the larynx, though, is it only works in conjunction with breath and the mouth and the head. And to create the voice, it needs to work with everything else in order to create that sound. It's not not isolated. In a way, as well, you'd need the whole body in a way to get the impression
to work.
No, no, no. We don't want the whole body.
I don't want the whole body. I'm saying that now. Okay, please.
No, we're gonna throw the rest of you away, Steve, and just keep the larynx. But thank you.
So, Polly, what exhibit would you like to donate to our museum?
I would like to donate a hog-nosed snake in a Tupperware box, please, if you don't have one already.
Okay. I don't think we do have one.
No, oddly enough. Oh, that's remiss of us.
Thank God you came along. That's very specific. Why the hog-nosed snake in the Tupperware box?
Well, as we've discussed, I do get sent some strange things in the post sometimes and I get offered odd things. I should say none of my animals are killed. They all die of natural causes. So I spend a lot of time on the phone to breeders or people who might be there at the point of death. So I've established some relationships with snake breeders or snake rescue centres. Most of whom are very helpful and, you know, doing really good things. But I've come across a couple of rather odd ones. People, I mean, not snakes. And one in particular was quite unreliable. And he just would never send things when I asked him to or when he said he was going to. And then he would send things without announcing them at other times, which isn't very convenient. And one day I remember I spent weeks trying to get these snakes from him that he'd said he had. He said he had a big box of 10 dead snakes that he'd collected over a year or so in his freezer and he was going to post them to me. And I had this lovely young intern working for me at the time. And then she texted me on the morning to say that they'd arrived. And I said, oh, wow, I'm so happy. You know, finally, he came through. And then she texted me very quickly again saying, call me. So I called her up. And she sounded really shaken when she answered the phone, and she said, Polly, the snakes, they did turn up. I mean, the box arrived, but it's not 10 dead snakes. And I said, well, what is it? And she said, it's one snake and it's alive. At this point, you know, I sort of said, okay, well, where is it? And she said, it's in a Tupperware box, and it's I've left it on the desk, and I've looked it up, and it's called a hognose snake. So at this point, I just thought, okay, this guy is just playing a joke on me, and he's, you know, he's always been unreliable and difficult, uh-huh. And I thought he'd obviously just decided to do something slightly malevolent. She said, don't worry, I've looked it up, it's not toxic. And then we did a little bit of research into it and found out that the hognose snake plays dead when it feels threatened, and does it so effectively that it can lie on its back for hours. I mean, well, just until the perceived threat has gone, to the point where it will emit a foul odor, it will open its jaw, and even if, you know, if it's got a little trick up its sleeve, it sometimes can produce a droplet of blood as well. To give the guy the benefit of the doubt, we think perhaps he had startled this snake before he packed it in the box, and he assumed it was dead and put it in looking like that. And she, fortunately, because all thanks to the Tupperware box, which I thought is crucial because it acted as quite a good observation chamber, she thought she saw it move, and then she thought she was going crazy because she came back to it and it was still lying dead. And then over a period of time, she left it there in the box and just watched, and then eventually it flipped itself over and started to move around again.
Wow, that's spooky. And is a snake the strangest animal you've ever found in a box?
No, not really. I mean, I have a history with dead animals. Obviously, I work with them, but my family, we had so many animals growing up. My dad worked with them. I think my mum slightly gave, I was a third child, and she gave up a little bit with me. And I would have sort of a bit of a menagerie. There was a bird flying around in my bedroom. It was an injured pigeon with a splint that was, my dad was trying to fix its broken leg on my floor. And then I had hamsters that I bred. I mean, I didn't really mean to breed them. I think we got two that we thought were female, and obviously that turned out to be wrong. And then we ended up with loads of them. And they were just always in the house, and they were dying, and, you know, we would bury them. And I remember once being out with my mum and sister. My sister was a teenager. She had a headache, and she was complaining about this headache to my mum. And my mum pulled out a box of anodyne from her handbag and said, well, take a couple of these, you know, you'll be okay. And my sister opened the box and screamed, and something fell on the floor. And we looked down, and it was this little, tiny, little dead, hard hamster.
Oh.
And my mum, who's very unfazed by anything, just went, oh, sorry, darling, wrong box. Because we would always be putting them in little boxes around the house before we buried them, and she picked up the wrong one that day.
So, Polly, you've donated the snake in the original Tupperware. Is that how you would like it to sit in the museum, or do you want something more elaborate?
No, I like the Tupperware. I like the humble things. It's a good observation chamber, I think, to watch it from.
Thank you, Polly, for bringing a hognose snake in a Tupperware box to the museum, and for the hysterical story that goes with it.
Wow. Randall, what would you like to give to the Museum of Curiosity?
I would like to donate 10 to the 39 liters of soup.
Okay.
Right, okay.
That's more than your recommended daily allowance of soup, I think. Why is it that you're giving us that?
Well, this comes from a question that someone asked me in What If 2. I find that some of the best science questions come from little kids. I think when adults ask a science question, they try to make sure it sounds smart. Like, they try to add in science concepts, or like ask a question where they think it has a really interesting scientific answer involving black holes or space time, or, you know, plutonium or the speed of light. And little kids ask sort of very simple questions where they don't know the answer. They don't have any idea what it's going to be. And there was a little girl named Amelia, who, 5 years old, who asked, what would happen if the solar system were filled with soup out to Jupiter? And I like this question because it ended up taking me through a lot of really interesting physics and sort of surprising branches of science. Because it turns out if you put that much soup in one place, it would be so massive that the gravitational pull would be strong enough that even light wouldn't be able to escape. So the soup would collapse inward toward a point and it would be a black hole. And then I went on to explore, like, what would it be like if you were inside it at the moment all this soup was created? And, you know, how long would you last before you were crushed? And this ended up being, like, one of my favorite questions that anyone had asked, looking at what would happen to the solar system, to everything inside it, and eventually to the galaxy as the soup started gobbling up nearby stars and cutting a swath through the Milky Way.
I seem to remember in the book she's called Amelia the Destroyer. You kindly christened her. So she gets a lot of blame for this. I bet she's pleased.
Yes, I feel like if I'm a kid, I would be, you know, they'd say this has caused a huge catastrophe, you know, and I the 5-year-old part of me definitely would want credit.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Just on soup and how children can be deployed for science, there was this amazing study, I think a couple of years ago, where it was a parent at a London school called Jake Baum, and he wanted to find out cures for malaria, basically. So he was a professor of cell biology and infectious diseases, and he suggested to the teacher of the school where his kids went that all the kids bring in a vial of the soup that their parents made for them when they're sick, and then they spin out the soup in a centrifuge, and then they test it on malaria parasites, and they'd see if there's anything useful in it. So all the kids brought in all the soups, and he actually found 5 of the soups reduced the growth of malarial parasites, which is about the same as the leading malarial drug. So
was one of them chicken soup? Because that always seems to be the one people suggest.
Yes,
whenever you're
there was
ill.
Definitely some chicken soup, although the massive flaw in his study was he forgot to ask the parents to write down the recipes. So when he got the 5 key ones, they couldn't actually remember what was in there.
No, what was in it.
Yeah.
You know, with any of those studies, anytime I see a study that says, you know, this substance will reduce the growth of this bacteria in a petri dish or the growth of cancer cells, I always like to remind people, so will a handgun.
It's a good point from the scientists on the panel. Okay, so Randall, we've got your 10 to the 39 liters of soup in the museum that is going to destroy us all. So can I suggest that we don't accept it all at once? Can we take it in installments, maybe starting with 10 liters, so a few cans? And if you're okay with that, how would you like us to display it?
I think next to the schedule showing when the next cans are going to be delivered, because I like either it's going to be a schedule that's like you have 30 seconds and there's more soup coming in, or even if you do that, the schedule will have to go on to like, you know, past the lifetime of the universe.
Uh-huh.
Be like on Tuesday, and then there's like a whole bunch of digits for the year. We're going to be getting another 10 liters of soup.
Is the schedule going to end up being so long that that creates a black hole and sucks us all in?
You know, it might. Mm, yes.
We could have a problem.
You know what? You've derailed me for the next 20 minutes. I've got to figure out how long would it be to write out.
Okay.
How many sheets of paper does that take, and how massive would that be?
Right, we'll leave you to that. We'll expect an answer by the end of the show.
Just the paper to write it down is going to create a black hole. It's fraught with danger, this. But listen, thank you, Randall. We're delighted to accept 10 litres of your soup into the museum as a first instalment, and we look forward to building it up to the full amount gradually over time until the end of the universe. So there we have it. The museum's collection now includes a voice box, a snake in a box, and a bucket of soup. Sounds like a new tasting menu from Heston Blumenthal. I'd like to thank Steve, Polly, and Randall, and I'll leave you with Albert Einstein's much less famous equation. If A is success in life, then A equals X plus Y plus Z. Work is X, play is Y, and Z is keeping your mouth shut. That's all from me and from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Anna Toshinsky. The donors were Polly Morgan, Randall Munro, and Steve Nallen. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Turner, Mandy Fenton, Jade Gebby, Cameron Loxdale, and Lydia Meisen. The producers were Sam Holmes and Liang Lee, and it was a BBC Studios production for Radio 4.
And this time tomorrow, Mark Watson looks at the week that was as a metaphor for our lives, doubtless exploring the many and varied dangers of messaging services.
On BBC iPlayer.
From the wilds of County Kerry to the Caledonian pine forest, from the Yorkshire moors to the reed beds of Suffolk, from an ant's nest in Gloucestershire to beneath the waves in Shetland, our magical wildlife revealed close to home.
Wild Isles with David Attenborough starts next Sunday night on BBC iPlayer.